background.
He's a full arcanist,
Will nodded.
He's Kelvin's second in command. He teaches sigildry to the newer students.
Sim cleared his throat.
As I was saying, Elodin was the youngest ever admitted, youngest to make arcanist, and youngest to be chancellor. Even so, I said, you have to admit he's a little odd to be chancellor.
Not back then, Simon said soberly. That was before it happened.
When nothing more was forthcoming, I prompted.
It?
Will shrugged.
Something. They do not speak on it. They locked him in the crockery until he got most of his marbles back.
I don't like thinking about it, Simon said, shifting uncomfortably in his chair.
I mean, a couple of students go crazy every term, right?
He looked at Willem.
Remember Slith?
Will nodded somberly.
It might happen to any of us.
There was a moment of silence as the two of them sipped their drinks, not looking at anything in particular. I wanted to ask for specifics, but I could tell that it was a touchy subject.
Anyway, Sim said in a low voice, I heard they didn't let him out of the crockery. I heard he escaped. No arcanist worth his salt can be kept in a cell, I said. That's not surprising. Have you ever been there?
Simon asked.
It's built to keep arcanists locked up, all meshed stone, wards on the doors and windows.
He shook his head.
I can't imagine how someone could get out, even one of the masters.
All this is beside the path, Willem said firmly, bringing us back to task. Kelvin has welcomed you to the fishery. Impressing him will be your best chance at making Raylar.
He looked back and forth between us.
Agreed.
Agreed,
Simon said. I nodded, but the wheels in my head were spinning. I was thinking about Tabor in the Great, who knew the names of all things. I thought about the story Scarpy had told back in Tarbin. He hadn't mentioned arcanists, only namers. And I thought of Elodin, Master Namer, and how I might approach him.
Chapter 45 Interlude Some Tavern Tale. At a gesture from Quoth, Chronicler wiped off the nib of his pen and shook out his hand. Bast gave a great seated stretch, his arms arching over the back of the chair.
I'd almost forgotten how quickly it all happened, Quoth mused. Those were probably the first stories anyone ever told about me.
They're still telling them at the university, Chronicler said. I've heard three different versions of the class you taught. You're whipping, too. Is that when they started calling you Quoth the Bloodless?
Quoth nodded.
Possibly.
If we're asking questions, Rishi, Bast said sheepishly, I was wondering why you didn't go looking for Scarpy.
What could I have done, Bast? Smeared my face with lamp black and staged a daring midnight rescue?
Quoth gave a brief, humorless laugh.
They'd taken him in on heresy. All I could do was hope he truly had friends in the church.
Quoth drew a deep breath and sighed.
But the simplest reason is the least satisfying one, I suppose. The truth is this. I wasn't living in a story.
I don't think I'm understanding you, Reshi,
Bast said, puzzled.
Think of all the stories you've heard, Bast. You have a young boy, the hero. His parents are killed, he sets out for vengeance. What happens next?
Bast hesitated, his expression puzzled. Chronicler answered the question instead.
He finds help. A clever talking squirrel, an old drunken swordsman, a mad hermit in the woods, that sort of thing.
Quoth nodded.
Exactly. He finds the mad hermit in the woods, proves himself worthy, and learns the names of all things, just like Tarbolin the Great. Then, with these powerful magics at his beck and call, what does he do?
Chronicler shrugged.
He finds the villains and kills them. Of course, Quoth said grandly. Clean, quick, and easy as lying. We know how it ends, practically, before it starts. That's why stories appeal to us. They give us the clarity and simplicity our real lives lack.
Quoth leaned forward.
If this were some tavern tale, all half-truth and senseless adventure, I would tell you how my time at the university was spent with a purity of dedication. I would learn the ever-changing name of the wind, ride out and gain my revenge against the Chandrian.
Quoth snapped his fingers sharply.
Simple as that. But while this might make for an entertaining story, it would not be the truth. The truth is this. I had mourned my parents' death for 3 years, and the pain of it had faded to a dull ache.
Quoth made a conciliatory gesture with one hand, and smiled a tight smile.
I won't lie to you. There were times late at night when I lay sleepless and desperately alone in my narrow bunk in the mews, times when I was choked with a sorrow so endless and empty that I thought it would smother me. There were times when I would see a mother holding her child or a father laughing with his son, and anger would flare up in me, hot and furious with the memory of blood and the smell of burning hair.
Quoth shrugged.
But there was more to my life than revenge. I had very real obstacles to overcome close at hand. My poverty, my low birth, the enemies I made at the university were more dangerous to me than any of the Chandrian.
He gestured for Chronicler to pick up his pen.
But for all that, we still see that even the most fanciful of stories hold a shred of truth. Because I did find something very near to the mad hermit in the woods.
Quoth smiled.
And I was determined to learn the name of the wind.
Chapter 46. The Ever-Changing Wind. Elodin proved a difficult man to find. He had an office in Hollows, but never seemed to use it. When I visited ledgers and lists, I discovered he only taught one class, unlikely maths. However, this was less than helpful in tracking him down, as according to the ledger, the time of the class was now and the location was everywhere. In the end, I spotted him through sheer luck across a crowded courtyard. He was wearing his black master's robes, which was something of a rarity. I was on my way to the medica for observation, but decided I'd rather be late for my class than miss the opportunity to speak with him. By the time I struggled through the midday crowd and caught up with him, we were on the northern edge of the university, following a wide dirt road that led into the forest.
Master Elodin, I said, pelting up to him. I was hoping I could talk with you.
A sad little hope,
he said without breaking stride or looking in my direction.
You should aim higher. A young man ought to be a fire with high ambitions.
I hope to study naming, then, I said, falling into step beside him.
Too high,
he said matter-of-factly.
Try again, somewhere in between.
The dirt road curved and trees blocked the sight of the university's buildings behind us.
I hope you'll accept me as a student, I tried again. And teach me whatever you think best?
Elodin stopped walking abruptly and turned to face me.
Fine, he said. Go find me 3 pine cones.
He made a circle with his thumb and finger. This big, without any of the little bits broken off. He sat down right in the middle of the road and made a shooing motion with his hand.
Go on, hurry.
I darted off into the surrounding trees. It took me about 5 minutes to find 3 pine cones of the appropriate type. By the time I got back to the road, I was disheveled and bramble-scratched. Elodin was nowhere to be seen. I looked around stupidly, then cursed, dropped the pine cones, and took off running, following the road north. I caught up with him fairly quickly, as he was just idling along, looking at the trees.
So what did you learn?
Elodin asked.
That you want to be left alone?
You are quick.
He spread his arms dramatically and intoned.
Here endeth the lesson. Here endeth my profound tutelage of Elia Quoth.
I sighed. If I left now, I could still catch my class in the Medica. But part of me suspected that this might be a test of some sort. Perhaps Elodine was simply making sure that I was genuinely interested before he accepted me as a student. That is the way it usually goes in stories. The young man has to prove his dedication to the old hermit in the woods before he's taken under his wing.
Will you answer a few questions?
I asked. Fine, he said, holding up his hand with his thumb and forefinger curled in. 3 questions, if you agree to leave me be afterwards. I thought for a moment.
Why don't you want to teach me?
Because the Ademaru make exceptionally poor students, he said brusquely. They are fine for rote learning, but the study of naming requires a level of dedication that ravels such as yourself rarely possess.
My temper flared so hot and quick that I actually felt my skin flush. It started at my face and burned down my chest and arms. It made the hair on my arms prickle. I took a deep breath.
I'm sorry that your experience with the Roo has left something to be desired, I said carefully. Let me assure you that—
ye gods, Elodin sighed, disgusted. A bootlicker too. You lack the requisite spine and testicular fortitude to study under me.
Hot words boiled up inside me. I fought them down. He was trying to bait me.
You aren't telling me the truth, I said. Why don't you want to teach me?
For the same reason I don't want a puppy,
Elodin shouted, waving his arms in the air like a farmer trying to startle crows out of a field.
Because you're too short to be a namer. Your eyes are too green. You have the wrong number of fingers. Come back when you're taller and you've found a decent pair of eyes.
We stared at each other for a long while. Finally, he shrugged and started walking again.
Fine. I'll show you why.
We followed the road north. Elodin strolled along, picking up stones and tossing them into the trees. He jumped to snatch leaves from low-hanging branches, his master's robes billowing ridiculously. At one point, he stopped and stood motionless and intent for nearly half an hour, staring at a fern swaying slowly in the wind. But I kept the tip of my tongue firmly between my teeth. I didn't ask, "Where are we going?" or "What are you looking at?" I knew 100 stories about young boys who squandered questions or wishes by chatting them away. I had 2 questions left, and I was going to make them count. Eventually, we emerged from the forest, and the road became a path leading up a vast lawn to a huge manor house. Bigger than the artificery, it had elegant lines, a red tile roof, high windows, arched doorways and pillars. There were fountains, flowers, hedges. But something wasn't quite right. The closer we got to the gates, the more I doubted this was some nobleman's estate. Maybe it was something about the design of the gardens or the fact that the wrought iron fence surrounding the lawns was nearly 10 feet tall and unclimbable to my well-trained thief's eye. 2 serious-eyed men opened the gate, and we continued up the path toward the front doors. Elodin looked at me.
Have you heard of Haven yet?
I shook my head.
It has other names. The Rookery, the Crockery,
the University Asylum.
It's huge. How?
I stopped before asking the question. Elodin grinned, knowing he'd almost caught me.
Jeremy,
he called out to the large man who stood at the front door.
How many guests do we have today?
The desk could give you a count, sir, he said uncomfortably.
Take a wild guess, Elodin said. We're all friends here.
320,
the man said with a shrug.
350?
Elodin rapped on the thick timber door with a knuckle, and the man scrambled to unlock it.
How many more could we fit in if we need it?
Elodin asked him.
Another 150 easy,
Jeremy said, tugging the huge door open.
More in a pinch, I suppose.
See, quoth,
Elodin winked at me. We're ready. The entryway was huge, with stained glass windows and vaulted ceilings. The floor was marble polished to a mirror sheen. The place was eerily silent. I couldn't understand it. The Reftview Asylum in Tarbin was only a fraction the size of this place, and it sounded like a brothel full of angry cats. You could hear it from a mile away over the din of the city. Elodine strolled up to a large desk where a young woman stood.
"Why isn't anyone outside, Emmy?"
She gave him an uneasy smile.
"They're too wild today, sir. We think there's a storm coming in."
She pulled a ledger book off the shelf.
"The moon's getting full, too. You know how it gets."
"Sure do."
Elodin crouched down and began to unlace his shoes.
"Where did they stash when this time?"
She flipped a few pages in the ledger.
"Second floor east, 247.
Elodin stood back up and set his shoes on the desk.
"Keep an eye on these, would you?"
She gave him an uncertain smile and nodded. I choked down another mouthful of questions.
"It seems like the university goes to an awful lot of expense here," I commented.
Elodin ignored me and turned to climb a wide marble staircase in his stocking feet. Then we entered a long white hallway, lined with wooden doors. For the first time, I could hear the sounds I had expected in a place like this. Moans, weeping, incessant chattering, screaming, all very faint. Elodin ran for a few steps, then stopped, his stocking feet gliding across the smooth marble floor, his master's robes streaming out behind him. He repeated this, a few quick steps, then a long slide with his arms held out to the sides for balance. I continued to pace along beside him.
"I'd think the masters would find other more academic uses for the university's funds."
Elodin didn't look at me. Step, 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 step.
"You're trying to get me to answer questions you're not asking."
Slide.
"It's not going to work.
You're trying to trick me into asking questions," I pointed out. "It seems only fair."
Step, 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 slide.
"So why the hell are you bothering with me anyway?"
Elodin asked.
"Kelvin likes you well enough. Why not hitch your star to his wagon?"
"I think you know things I can't learn anywhere else."
"Things like what?"
"Things I've wanted to know since I first saw someone call the wind."
"Name of the wind, was it?"
Elodin raised his eyebrows. Step, 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 step.
"That's tricky."
Slide.
"What makes you think I know anything about calling the wind?"
"Process of elimination,"
I said.
"None of the other masters do that sort of thing, so it must be your bailiwick."
"By your logic, I should also be in charge of solenad dancers, needlework, and horse thieving."
We came to the end of the hall. Mid-slide, Elodin nearly bowled over a huge, broad-shouldered man carrying a hardback.
"Beg your pardon, sir," he said,
though it obviously wasn't his fault.
"Timothy,"
Elodin pointed a long finger at him.
"Come with us."
Elodin led the way through several shorter hallways, eventually coming to a heavy wooden door with a sliding panel at eye level. Elodin opened it and peered through.
"How's he been?"
"Quiet,"
the hulking man said.
"I don't think he slept much."
Elodin tried the latch, then turned to the broad-shouldered man, his face going grim.
"You locked him in?"
The man stood a full head taller than Elodin and probably weighed twice as much, but the blood drained from his face as the shoeless master glared at him.
"Not me, Master Elodin, it's..."
Elodin cut him off with a sharp gesture.
"Unlock it!"
Timothy fumbled with a ring of keys. Elodin continued to stare him down.
"Alder Huynh is not to be confined. He may come and go as he pleases. Nothing is to be put on his food unless he specifically asks for it. I'm holding you responsible for this, Timothy Jenneroy."
Elodin poked him in the chest with a long finger.
"If I find out that Huynh has been sedated or restrained, I'll ride you naked through the streets of Imre like a little pink pony."
He glared.
"Go."
The fellow left as quickly as he could manage without actually breaking into a run. Elodin turned to me.
"You can come in, but don't make any noises or sudden movements. Don't talk unless he talks to you. If you do talk, keep your voice low. Understand?
I nodded and he opened the door. The room wasn't what I'd expected. Tall windows let the daylight in, revealing a sizable bed and a table with chairs. The walls, ceiling, and floor were all padded with thick white cloth, muffling even the faint noises from the hallway. The blankets had been pulled off the bed, and a thin man of about 30 was bundled up in them, huddled against the wall. Elodin closed the door, and the mousy man flinched a little.
"When?"
he said softly, moving closer.
"What happened?"
Alder Wynne looked up owlishly. A thin stick of a man, he was bare-chested under the blanket, his hair in wild disarray, his eyes round and wide. He spoke softly, his voice cracking a little.
"I was fine. I was doing fine. But all the people, talking, dogs, cobblestones. I just can't be around that right now."
Wynne pressed himself against the wall and the blanket fell off his bony shoulder. I was startled to see a lead guilder around his neck. This man was a full-fledged arcanist. Elodie nodded.
"Why are you on the floor?"
Wynne looked over at the bed, panic in his eyes.
"I'll fall,"
he said softly, his voice somewhere between horror and embarrassment.
"And there are springs and slats, nails." "How are you now?"
Elodin asked gently. "Would you like to come back with me?"
"No!"
Wynne gave a hopeless, despairing cry, screwing his eyes closed and pulling the blanket closer around himself. His thin, reedy voice made his plea more heart-wrenching than if he'd howled it.
"It's fine, you can stay,"
Elodin said softly.
"I'll be back to visit."
Wynne opened his eyes at this, looking agitated.
"Don't bring thunder,"
he said urgently. He reached one thin hand out of his blanket and clutched at Elodin's shirt.
"But I do need a cat whistle and blue down, and bones too."
His tone was urgent.
"Tent bones?"
"I'll bring them," Elodin reassured him, gesturing for me to back out of the room. I did. Elodin closed the door behind us, his expression grim. Wynne knew what he was getting into when he became my giller. He turned and began to walk down the hall.
You don't know anything about the university, about the risks involved. You think this place is a fairyland, a playground. It's not."
"That's right," I snapped. "It's a playground, and all the other children are jealous because I got to play Get Whipped Bloody and banned from the archives, and they didn't." Elodin stopped walking and turned to look at me.
"Fine. Prove me wrong. Prove that you've thought this through. Why does a university with under 1,500 students need an asylum the size of the Royal Palace?"
My mind raced. "Most students are from well-to-do families," I said. "They've led easy lives. When forced to—"
"Wrong,"
Elodin said dismissively, turning to walk down the hall.
"It is because of what we study, because of the way we train our minds to move."
"So ciphering and grammar make people crazy,"
I said, taking care to phrase it as a statement. Elodin stopped walking and wrenched open the nearest door. Panicked screaming burst out into the hallway.
They're at me!
Through the open door, I could see a young man thrashing against the leather restraints that bound him to the bed at wrist, waist, neck, and ankle.
"Trigonometry and diagrammed logic don't do this,"
Elodin said, looking me in the eye.
They're in me!
The screaming continued in an unbroken chant, like the endless, mindless barking of a dog at night. Elodin closed the door. Though I could still hear the screaming faintly through the thick door, the near silence was stunning.
"Do you know why they call this place the Rookery?"
Elodin asked.
I shook my head.
Because it's where you go if you are a raven.
He smiled a wild smile.
He laughed, a terrible laugh.
Elodine led me through a long series of hallways to a different wing of the crockery. Finally, we turned a corner, and I saw something new, a door made entirely of copper. Elodine took a key from his pocket and unlocked it.
I like to stop in when I'm back in the neighborhood,
he said casually as he opened the door. Check my mail, water the plants and such. He pulled off one of his socks, tied a knot in it, and used it to wedge the door open.
It's a nice place to visit, but, you know...
He tugged on the door, making sure it wouldn't swing closed.
Not again.
The first thing I noticed about the room was something strange about the air. At first, I thought it might be soundproofed like older winds, but looking around, I saw the walls and ceilings were bare gray stone. Next, I thought the air might be stale, except when I drew a breath, I smelled lavender and fresh linen. It was almost like there was a pressure on my ears, as if I were deep underwater, except, of course, that I wasn't. I waved a hand in front of me, almost expecting the air to feel different, thicker. It didn't.
Pretty irritating, huh?
I turned around to see Elodine watching me.
I'm surprised you noticed, actually. Not many do.
The room was a definite step above Alder Wynne's. It had a four-post bed with curtains, an overstuffed couch, an empty bookcase, and a large table with several chairs. Most notable were the huge windows looking out over the lawns and gardens. I could see a balcony outside, but there didn't seem to be any way to get to it.
Watch this, Elodin said.
He picked up one of the high-backed wooden chairs, lifted it with both hands, spun in a circle, and flung it hard at the window. I cringed, but instead of a terrible crash, there was just a dull splintering of wood. The chair fell to the floor in a ruined tangle of timber and upholstery.
I used to do that for hours, Elodin said, drawing a deep breath and looking around the room fondly. Good times.
I went to look at the windows. They were thicker than usual, but not that thick. They seemed normal except for faint reddish streaks running through them. I glanced at the window frame. It was copper, too. I looked slowly around the room, eyeing its bare stone walls, feeling its strangely heavy air. I noticed the door didn't even have a handle on the inside, let alone a lock. Why would anyone go through all the trouble of making a solid copper door? I decided on my second question.
How did you get out?
Finally,
Elodin said with a tinge of exasperation. He slouched onto the couch.
You see, once upon a time, Elodin the Great found himself locked in a high tower.
He gestured to the room around us.
He had been stripped of his tools, his coin, key, and candle. Furthermore, his cell had no door worth mentioning. No window that could be breached.
He made dismissive gestures at each of these.
Even the name of the wind was hidden from him by the clever machinations of his captors.
Elodin got up from the couch and began to pace the room.
All around him was nothing but smooth, hard stone. It was a cell no man had ever escaped.
He stopped pacing and held up a finger dramatically.
But Elodin the Great knew the names of all things, and so all things were his to command.
He faced the gray wall beside the windows.
He said to the stone, "Break!" And
Elodin trailed off, his head tilting to one side curiously, his eyes narrowed.
Sod me, they changed it,
he said quietly to himself.
Huh.
He stepped closer to the wall and lay a hand on it. I let my attention wander. Will and Sim had been right. The man was cracked in the head. What would happen if I ran out of the room, unstuck the door, and slammed it? Would the other masters thank me?
Ha 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 ho!
Elodin said suddenly, laughing.
That was half clever of them.
He took two steps back from the wall.
Fier Basalian!
I saw the wall move. It rippled like a hanging rug thumped with a stick. Then it simply fell. Like dark water poured from a bucket, tons of fine grey sand spilled across the floor in a sudden rush, burying Elodin's feet up to his shins. Sunlight and birdsong poured into the room. Where there had been a foot of solid grey stone before, there was now a gaping hole big enough to drive a cart through. But the hole wasn't completely clear. Some green material was spread across the opening. It almost looked like a dirty, tangled net, but it was too irregular for netting. It was more like a thick, tattered cobweb.
That wasn't there before,
Elodin said apologetically as he pulled his feet free of the grey sand.
It was much more dramatic the first time, let me assure you.
I simply stood, stunned by what I'd just seen. This wasn't sympathy. This wasn't anything I'd ever seen before. All I could think of was the old line from 100 half-remembered stories.
And Tarballin the Great said to the stone, "Break," and the stone broke.
Elodin wrenched off one of the chair's legs and used it to batter at the tangled green web that stretched across the opening. Parts of it broke easily or flaked away. Where it was thicker, he used the leg as a lever to bend pieces aside. Where it bent or broke, it glimmered bright in the sunlight. More copper, I thought, veins of copper running through the blocks of stone that made the wall. Elodin dropped the chair leg and ducked through the gap. Through the window, I saw him lean against the white stone railing on the balcony. I followed him outside. As soon as I stepped onto the balcony, the air no longer felt strangely heavy and still.
2 years, he said, looking out over the gardens. Able to see this balcony but not stand on it. Able to see the wind but not hear it, not feel it on my face.
He swung one leg up over the stone railing, so he was sitting on it, then dropped a few feet to land on the flat piece of roof just underneath. He wandered out across the roof, away from the building. I hopped the rail myself and followed him to the edge of the roof. We were only about 20 feet up, but the gardens and fountains spreading out on all sides made for a spectacular view. Elodin stood perilously near the edge, his master's robe flapping around him like a dark flag. He looked rather impressive, actually, if you were willing to ignore the fact that he was still only wearing one sock. I went to stand beside him on the edge of the roof. I knew what my third question had to be.
What do I have to do, I asked, to study naming under you?
He met my eye calmly, appraising me.
Jump, he said. Jump off this roof.
That's when I realized that all of this had been a test. Elodin had been taking my measure ever since we met. He had a grudging respect for my tenacity, and he had been surprised that I noticed something odd about the air in his room. He was on the verge of accepting me as a student, but he needed more proof of my dedication, a demonstration, a leap of faith. And as I stood there, a piece of story came to mind. So Tarballin fell, but he did not despair, for he knew the name of the wind, and so the wind obeyed him. It cradled and caressed him. It bore him to the ground as gently as a puff of thistledown. It set him on his feet, softly as a mother's kiss. Elodin knew the name of the wind. Still looking him in the eye, I stepped off the edge of the roof. Elodin's expression was marvelous. I have never seen a man so astonished. I spun slightly as I fell, so he stayed in my line of vision. I saw him raise one hand slightly as if making a belated attempt to grab hold of me. I felt weightless, like I was floating.
Then I struck the ground. Not gently, like a feather settling down, hard, like a brick hitting a cobblestone street. I landed on my back with my left arm beneath me. My vision went dark as the back of my head struck the ground and all the air was driven from my body. I didn't lose consciousness. I just lay there, breathless and unable to move. I remember thinking quite earnestly that I was dead, that I was blind. Eventually my sight returned, leaving me blinking against the sudden brightness of the blue sky. Pain tore through my shoulder and I tasted blood. I couldn't breathe. I tried to roll off my arm, but my body wouldn't listen to me. I had broken my neck, my back. After a long, terrifying moment, I managed to gasp a shallow breath, then another. I gave a sigh of relief and realized that I had at least one broken rib in addition to everything else. But I moved my fingers slightly, then my toes. They worked. I hadn't broken my spine. As I lay there, counting my blessings and broken ribs, Elodin stepped into my field of vision. He looked down at me.
"Congratulations," he said. "That was the stupidest thing I've ever seen."
His expression was a mix of awe and disbelief.
"Ever."
And that is when I decided to pursue the noble arts of artificing. Not that I had a lot of other options. Before helping me limp to the Medica, Elodin made it clear that anyone stupid enough to jump off a roof was too reckless to be allowed to hold a spoon in his presence, let alone study something as profound and volatile as naming. Nevertheless, I wasn't terribly put out by Elodin's refusal. Storybook magic or no, I was not eager to study under a man whose first set of lessons had left me with 3 broken ribs, a mild concussion, and a dislocated shoulder. Chapter 47 Barbs. Aside from its rocky start, my first term went fairly smoothly. I studied in the Medica, learning more about the body and how to heal it. I practiced my Siaru with Willem and helped him with his Arturan in exchange. I joined the ranks of the artificery, studying how to blow glass, mix alloys, draw wire, inscribe metal, and sculpt stone. Most evenings I came back to Kilvin's workshop to work. I chipped casings off bronze castings, washed glassware, and ground ore for alloys. It was not demanding work, but every span Kilvin gave me a copper jot, sometimes 2. I suspected there was a great tally board in that methodical mind of his, carefully marking down the hours each person worked. I learned things of a less academic nature as well. Some of my Arcanum bunkmates taught me a card game called Dog's Breath. I returned the favor by giving an impromptu lesson on psychology, probability, and manual dexterity. I won almost 2 whole talents before they stopped inviting me back to their games. I became tight friends with Willem and Simon. I had some few others, but not many and none so close as Will and Sim. My swift rise to Elia alienated me from most of the other students. Whether they resented or admired me, most students held themselves apart. And there was Ambrose. To deem us simply enemies is to lose the true flavor of our relationship. It was more like the two of us entered into a business partnership in order to more efficiently pursue our mutual interest of hating each other. However, even with my vendetta against Ambrose, I still had a great deal of time on my hands. Since I wasn't able to spend it in the archives, I spent some time nurturing my budding reputation. You see, my dramatic entrance to the university had made quite a stir. I'd made my way into the Arcanum in 3 days instead of the usual 3 terms. I was the youngest member by almost 2 years. I had openly defied one of the masters in front of his own class and avoided expulsion. When whipped, I hadn't cried out or bled. On top of everything else, I had apparently managed to infuriate Master Elodin to such an extent that he had thrown me off the roof of the crockery. I let that story circulate uncorrected, as it was preferable to the embarrassing truth. Altogether, it was enough to start a steady stream of rumour around me, and I decided to take advantage of it. Reputation is like a sort of armour, or a weapon you can brandish if need be. I decided that if I was going to be an arcanist, I might as well be a well-known arcanist. So I let slip a few pieces of information. I had been admitted without a letter of recommendation. The masters had given me 3 talents to attend, rather than make me pay a tuition. I had survived for years on the streets of Tarbin, living off my wits. I even started a few rumours that were pure nonsense, lies so outrageous that people would repeat them despite the fact that they were obviously untrue. I had demon blood in me. I could see in the dark. I only slept an hour each night. When the moon was full, I would talk in my sleep, speaking a strange language no one could understand. Basil, my former bunkmate from Muse, helped me start these rumours. I would make up the stories, he would tell a few people, then together we would watch them spread like a fire in a field. It was an amusing hobby. But my ongoing feud with Ambrose added to my reputation more than anything else. Everyone was stunned that I dared openly defy a powerful noble's firstborn son. We had several dramatic encounters that first term. I won't bore you with the details. We'd cross paths and he would make some offhand comment loud enough for everyone in the room to hear, or he would sneer at me under the guise of a compliment. You must tell me who cuts your hair. Anyone with a lick of common sense knew how to deal with arrogant nobility. The tailor I had terrorized back in Tarbin knew what to do. You take your lumps, duck your head, and get the whole thing over as quickly as possible. But I always fought back. And while Ambrose was intelligent and reasonably well-spoken, he was no match for my trooper's tongue. I'd been raised on the stage, and my sharp, rue wits ensured that I got the better of our exchanges. Still, Ambrose continued to seek me out like a dog too stupid to avoid a porcupine. He would snap at me and leave with a face full of barbs, and each time we parted ways, we hated each other just a little more. People noticed, and by the end of the term, I had a reputation for reckless bravery. But the truth is, I was merely fearless. There's a difference, you see. In Tarbin, I'd learned real fear. I feared hunger, pneumonia, guards with hobnail boots, older boys with bottle glass knives. Confronting Ambrose required no real bravery on my part. I simply couldn't muster any fear of him. I saw him as a puffed-up clown. I thought he was harmless. I was a fool. Chapter 48. Interlude. A silence of a different kind. Bast sat in the Waystone Inn and tried to keep his hands motionless in his lap. He had counted 15 breaths since Kvothe had spoken last, and the innocent silence that had gathered like a clear pool around the 3 men was beginning to darken into a silence of a different kind. Bast took another breath, 16, and braced himself against the moment he feared would come. It would not be to Bast's credit to say that he was afraid of nothing, as only fools and priests are never afraid, but it is true that very few things unnerved him. Heights, for instance, he didn't care for very much, and the great summer storms that came through these parts that blackened the sky and tore up deep-rooted oaks made him feel uncomfortably small and helpless. But when you come down to it, nothing really frightened him, not storms, not tall ladders, not even a scrail. Bast was brave by being largely fearless. Nothing would turn him pale, or if it did, he didn't stay pale for very long. Oh, certainly he didn't relish the thought of someone hurting him,
stabbing him with bitter iron, searing him with hot coals, that sort of thing. But just because he didn't like the thought of his blood on the outside didn't mean he was really afraid of those things. He just didn't want them to happen. To really fear something, you have to dwell on it. And since there was nothing that preyed on Bast's waking mind in this fashion, there was nothing his heart truly feared. But hearts can change. 10 years ago, he had lost his grip climbing a tall rennel tree to pick fruit for a girl he fancied. After he slipped, he had hung for a long minute, head down, before falling. In that long minute, a small fear rooted inside him and had stayed with him ever since. In the same way, Bast had learned a new fear of late. A year ago, he had been fearless as any sane man can hope to be, but now Bast feared silence. Not the ordinary silence that came from a simple absence of things moving about and making noise. Bast feared the deep, weary silence that gathered around his master at times, like an invisible shroud. Bast breathed in again. 17. He fought not to wring his hands as he waited for the deep silence to invade the room. He waited for it to crystallize and show its teeth on the edges of the cool quiet that had pooled in the waystone. He knew how it came, like the frost that bleeds out of the winter ground, hardening the clear water that an early thaw leaves in wagon ruts. But before Bast could draw another breath, Kvothe straightened in his chair and made a motion for Chronicler to lay down his pen. Bast nearly wept as he sensed the silence scatter like a dark bird, startled into flight. Kvothe gave a sigh that hovered between annoyance and resignation.
"I will admit," he said, "that I am not sure how to approach the next part of the story."
Afraid to let the silence stretch for too long, Bast chirruped, "Why don't you simply talk about what is most important first? Then you can go back and touch on other things if you need to."
"As if it were as simple as that," Kvothe said sharply. "What is most important? My magic or my music? My triumphs or my follies?"
Bast flushed a deep crimson and bit his lips. Kvothe let out his breath in a sudden rush.
"I am sorry, Bast. It's good advice, as all of your seemingly inane advice turns out to be."
He pushed his chair back from the table.
"But before we continue, the real world has certain calls on me that I can no longer ignore. If you will please excuse me for a moment."
Chronicler and Bast stood as well, stretching their legs and attending to calls of their own. Bast lit the lamps. Kvothe produced more cheese and bread and hard spiced sausage. They ate, and some small effort was made at polite conversation, but their minds were elsewhere, dwelling on the story. Bast ate half of everything. Chronicler accounted for a sizable, though more modest amount. Kvothe had a bite or two before he spoke.
"Onward, then. Music and magic, triumph and folly. Think now. What does our story need? What vital element is it lacking?"
"Women, Reshi," Bast said immediately. "There's a real paucity of women."
Kvothe smiled.
"Not women, Bast. A woman. The woman."
Kvothe looked at Chronicler.
"You have heard bits and pieces, I don't doubt. I will tell you the truth of her, though I fear I may not be equal to the challenge."
Chronicler picked up his pen, but before he could dip it, Kvothe held up a hand.
"Let me say one thing before I start. I have told stories in the past, painted pictures with words, told hard lies and harder truths. Once I sang colors to a blind man. 7 hours I played, but at the end he said he saw them green and red and gold. That, I think, was easier than this. Trying to make you understand her with nothing more than words. You have never seen her, never heard her voice. You cannot know."
Kvothe motioned for Chronicler to pick up his pen.
"But still I will try. She is in the wings now, waiting for her cue.
Let us set the stage for her arrival. Chapter 49 The Nature of Wild Things. As with all truly wild things, care is necessary in approaching them. Stealth is useless. Wild things recognize stealth for what it is, a lie and a trap. While wild things might play games of stealth, and in doing so may even occasionally fall prey to stealth, they are never truly caught by it. So, with slow care, rather than stealth, we must approach the subject of a certain woman. Her wildness is of such degree I fear approaching her too quickly, even in a story. Should I move recklessly, I might startle even the idea of her into sudden flight. So in the name of slow care, I will speak of how I met her, and to do that I must speak of the events that brought me quite unwillingly across the river and into Imre. I finished my first term with 3 silver talents and a single jot. Not long ago it would have seemed like all the money in the world to me. Now I simply hoped it would be enough for 1 more term's tuition and a bunk in the mews. The last span of every term at the university was reserved for admissions exams. Classes were cancelled and the masters spent several hours of each day conducting examinations. Your next term's tuition was based on your performance. A lottery determined what day and hour you would go through admissions. A great deal hung on the brief interview. Missing a few questions could easily double your tuition. Because of this, slots later in the span were highly prized as they gave students more time to study and prepare. There was a vigorous trade in appointment times after the lottery was held. Money and favors were bartered as everyone vied for a time that suited them. I was lucky enough to draw a mid-morning hour on Kendling, the last day of admissions. If I'd wanted to, I could have sold my slot, but I preferred to take the extra time to study. I knew my performance would have to be brilliant, as several of the masters were now less than impressed by me. My previous trick of spying was out of the question. I now knew it was grounds for expulsion, so I couldn't risk that. Despite the long days I spent studying with Will and Sim, admissions were difficult. I breezed through many of the questions, but Heme was openly hostile, asking questions with more than one answer so that nothing I said could be correct. Brandia was difficult as well, clearly helping Heme carry his grudge. Lauren was unreadable, but I sensed his disapproval rather than seeing it on his face. Afterwards I fidgeted while the masters discussed my tuition. Voices were calm and muted at first, then became somewhat louder. Eventually, Kilvin stood and shook her finger at Heme while shouting and pounding the table with his other hand. Heme maintained more composure than I would have if I had been faced with 20 stone of furious bellowing artificer. After the Chancellor managed to regain control of things, I was called forward and given my receipt.
Elia Kroth, fall term. Tuition, 3 talents. 9 jots, 7 drabs.
8 jots more than I had. As I walked out of the master's hall, I ignored the sinking feeling in my gut and tried to think of a way I could lay hands on more money by tomorrow noon. I made a brief stop at the 2 Kaldish money changers on this side of the river. As I suspected, they wouldn't lend me a thin shim. While I wasn't surprised, the experience was sobering, reminding me again of how different I was from the other students. They had families paying their tuition, granting them allowances to cover their living expenses. They had reputable names they could borrow against in a pinch. They had possessions they could pawn or sell. If worse came to worst, they had homes to return to. I had none of these things. If I couldn't come up with 8 more jots for tuition, I had nowhere in the world I could go. Borrowing from a friend seemed like the simplest option, but I valued my handful of friends too much to risk losing them over money.
As my father used to say, there are two sure ways to lose a friend. One is to borrow, the other to lend. Besides, I did my best to keep my desperate poverty to myself. Pride is a foolish thing, but it is a powerful force. I wouldn't ask them for money except as my very last resort. I briefly considered trying to cut-purse the money, but I knew it was a bad idea. If I were caught with my hand in someone's pocket, I would get more than a cuff round the head. At best, I'd be jailed and forced to stand against the iron law. At worst, I'd end up on the horns and expelled for conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum. I couldn't risk it. I needed a Gaelot, one of the dangerous men who lend money to desperate people. You might have heard them referred to romantically as copper hawks, but more often they're referred to as shimgalls or lets. Regardless of the name, they exist everywhere. The hard part is finding them. They tend to be rather secretive, as their business is semi-legal at best. But living in Tarbin had taught me a thing or two. I spent a couple of hours visiting the seedier taverns around the university, making casual conversations, asking casual questions. Then I visited a pawn shop called the Bent Penny and asked a few more pointed questions. Finally, I learned where I needed to go, over the river, to Imre. Chapter 50 Negotiations. Imre lay a little over 2 miles from the university on the eastern side of the Omathi River. Since it was a mere 2 days in a fast coach from Tarbin, a great many wealthy nobles, politicians, and courtiers made their homes there. It was conveniently close to the governing hub of the Commonwealth, while being a comfortable distance from the smell of rotten fish, hot tar, and the vomit of drunken sailors. Imre was a haven for the arts. There were musicians, dramatists, sculptors, dancers, and the practitioners of 100 other smaller arts, even the lowest art of all, poetry. Performers came because Imre offered what every artist needs most, an appreciative, affluent audience. Imre also benefited by its proximity to the university. Access to plumbing and sympathy lamps improved the quality of the town's air. Quality glass was easy to come by, so windows and mirrors were commonplace. Eyeglasses and other ground lenses, while expensive, were readily available. Despite this, there was little love lost between the two towns. Most of Imre's citizens did not like the thought of 1,000 minds tinkering with dark forces better left alone. Listening to the average citizen speak, it was easy to forget that this part of the world had not seen an arcanist burned for nearly 300 years. To be fair, it should be mentioned that the university had a vague contempt for Imre's populace too, viewing them as self-indulgent and decadent. The arts that were viewed so highly in Imre were seen as frivolous by those at the university. Often students who quit the university were said to have gone over the river, the implication being that minds that were too weak for academia had to settle for tinkering with the arts. And both sides of the river were, ultimately, hypocrites. University students complained about frivolous musicians and fluffhead actors, then lined up to pay for performances. Imre's population griped about unnatural arts being practiced 2 miles away, but when an aqueduct collapsed or someone fell suddenly sick, they were quick to call on engineers and doctors trained at the university. All in all, it was a long-standing and uneasy truce, where both sides complained while maintaining a grudging tolerance. Those people did have their uses after all. You just wouldn't want your daughter marrying one. Since Imre was such a haven for music and drama, you might think I spent a great deal of time there, but nothing could be further from the truth. I had been there only once. Willem and Simon had taken me to an inn where a trio of skilled musicians played, lute, flute, and drum. I bought a short beer for a halfpenny and relaxed, fully intending to enjoy an evening with my friends, but I couldn't. Bare minutes after the music started, I practically fled the room. I doubt very much you'll be able to understand why.
but I suppose I have to explain if things are to make any sense at all. I couldn't stand being near music and not be a part of it. It was like watching the woman you love bedding down with another man.